Loose Wig 8, Side 3.
At the bar, drunk with her boys. One strange chick I remember from somewhere, wearing a simple skirt with pockets, her hands in there, short haircut, slouched, talking to everybody. Up and down the stairs they come, the bartenders of the regular band of Jack and the heavenly drummer who looks up in the sky with blue eyes, with a beard. He's wailing beer caps of bottles and jamming at the cash register, and everything is going to the beat. It's the beat generation, it's Bayat. It's the beat to keep, it's the beat of the heart. It's being beat and down in the world and like old-time lowdown. And like in ancient civilizations, the slave boatmen rowing galleys to a beat, and servants spinning pottery to a beat. The faces, a face like Hunky's in New York, Hunky whom you'll see on Times Square, somnolent and alert, sad, sweet, and dark, holy, just out of jail, martyred, tortured by sidewalks, starved for sex and companionship, open to anything, ready to introduce a new world with shrug.
I like to reminisce a bit about the 4th of July because I had such a ball on the 4th. I know a lot of y'all went all out on the 4th and fished and hunt. I was out fishing. Yeah, I'd love to go fishing. And I was sitting in the boat and I was just rowing away. I was rowing away and I got carried away and was listening to the music and dropped one of my oars. And I kept on, I saw a fella coming toward me in another boat. He had two girls in his boat. And I called out to him, I said, hey buddy, can you let me use one of your oars? He said, he's not an oar, this is my mother and sister.
Well, you know, it's very strange. I'm going to say something that sounds like the very opposite of what I just said. And very often, you know, the truth has that quality that you can see it as two opposing things, making one. What I mean is that a man who fully enters into the life which we have today, and who does it very consciously and deliberately and enjoys what he's doing, it is almost as free, I would say, as the man who cuts adrift from it, you see. In other words, he's accepted. When you fully accept something, you are no longer victimized by it, do you see? But then those are rare men who do that. Again, don't you think? Many times, of course, I look at ordinary people, so-called common people, humble people, I would say, and I admire them, I envy them almost. They do not question as we are questioning one another now, or questioning the world or its ways. They have never raised their voice this way, do you see? They have taken what it has been offered them to do, and they've done it. And in a way, there's something beautiful and noble and big about that. They are simple souls. They are souls who, even if they do not express it in terms of faith in a religious way, really they are moving like religious figures, do you see? They've accepted their lot, they do not complain, and they get the most out of it.
Well, it's a pleasure and an honor to have John Coltrane in front of our microphone here. And John, I gotta be abrupt with you. I gotta say like this, that your playing has been turned antenna-like, unbeautiful, on just about everything you can think of. And since the playing mirrors the personality, I guess you have some personal thoughts of that kind to say.
Let me follow you again. You said my playing has on what?
I didn't say that. I said what the critics said.
Said, oh, well, they seem to think that it's an angry sort of thing. It's real. Some of them do. I don't know. But the critics here.
Do you feel angry?
No, I don't. I was talking to a fellow today, and I told him that the reason I play so many, it sounds angry because I'm trying so many things at one time, you see. Like, I haven't sorted them out. I have a whole bag of things that I'm trying to work through and get the one essential, you know.
Would you say that you're trying to play everything you hear one time or something like that?
No, there are some set things that I know, some devices that I know, harmonic devices that I know that will take me out of the ordinary path, you see, if I use these. But I haven't played them enough, and I'm not familiar with them enough yet to take the one single line through them. So I play all of them, you know, trying to acclimate my ear so I can hear, you know.
In the album liners of your latest LP, that was the Giant Steps LP, which we have played quite a lot on this show, you claim that you were trying to get, as I understood it, a more beautiful sound. What do you mean with that?
Well, I hope to play not necessarily a more beautiful sound, though I would like to, you know, just say tone-wise, I would like to be able to produce a more beautiful sound. But now I'm primarily interested in trying to work what I have, what I know, down into a more lyrical line. You know, that's what I mean by beautiful, by more lyrical, so to be, you know, easily understood.
I'm sure our listeners are, as they are, mainly collectors of Coltrane records, I'm sure they like to hear you express one thought of what you think is listenable among your whole production.
You mean of the albums that I made? I like Blue Train myself.
I figured you would.
There's such a good band on there, you know.
That's a real dangerous album, man.
It was a good recording.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about this last quartet recording here, the Giant Steps?
I think that was my best quartet recording so far. With the exception of maybe Soul Train, I'd put them both about the same.
How would you say working with Miles Davis has influenced you stylistically?
Well, it has led me into most of the things that I'm doing now, you know.
He has had a major stranglehold on you in that matter. I mean, he made you play the way you do, or you got a chance to play like
you
do.
Well, I've been free. I've been so free here, you know, that almost anything I want to try, I'm welcome to do it, you know. So that's the freedom has helped me.
I heard you were
experiment.
Splitting the Miles Quintet here, and then trying something on your own.
Yes, I am.
How's that? With whom?
I have several men in mind, but I haven't selected the side men yet. Yeah. I'm going to try with the quartet.
What do you feel like working with, a quartet?
Yeah, to begin with, and maybe in several weeks after I start, I might add a fifth man.
John, which tenor players do you think have influenced you, if any at all?
All of them. I would say all of them. But,
do you have a personal favorite? I mean, like you put on a record when you were at home and relaxing and so on.
Well, Sonny Rollins is, I think he's outstanding tenor man today, you know. And
That's exactly what Sonny Robert told me on this show about you. So
that's usually
it seems
to
be
man,
a mutual admiration society.
Yeah,
here.
Well, he's great. I mean, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the formative days,
well,
like years ago, it was Dexter Gordon that mm-hmm. actually was.
You do have a strong feeling for tradition, haven't you?
I guess so. I mean, I would like to even make it stronger. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to strengthen my roots, so to say, mm-hmm. you know, because I didn't start at the beginning, and there's a whole lot back there that's, you know, that all young musicians
do
should
you,
have.
Privately, I mean, when you're listening, you go back there, I mean, just on your own account and listen?
Well, I don't have many records in that era now, but I do plan to get them. I plan to include that in my repertoire, you know, all these old traditional things. I've been trying recently to search myself, you know, and try to find things that are reminiscent that sound like those things. But I'm really going to do some work on that soon.
Well, John, it seems like you're on with the Miles Davis Quintet here, and thank you very much for taking the time and dropping in on this
show. You're welcome. Thank you very much. Enjoy it.
You're listening to a live performance in the studios of Vermont Public Radio on the Evening Jazz program for this Tuesday night. Vocalist Nikki Corral, pianist Sonny Saul, bassist Chip Lau, and conga player, percussionist Michael Hanacek. And it's 27 minutes past 7 o'clock here, and you're listening to Jazz Till 9, and in this live performance, which is going on right now, we turn to the piano trio again, I believe, and another original by Sonny.
Hey, thanks. This is a composition I wrote in 1986 for a young dancer that I knew named Alix Shuttle. And this is called Alix's Dream, and it's about her ambition in dance. You'll hear in listening to this tune, it's divided into three sections. There's a 3-4 section in the beginning, a 4-4 section, and a 5-4 section, and you'll hear us highlight these. Thank you.
you become conscious of breathing, you get the sense that you are doing it in the same way as thinking or walking. But if you forget about it, it goes on. And you don't have to do it at all. That is why breathing exercises are fundamental in all meditation practices in the Orient. Because you can understand through breathing and through the experience of breathing that there really is no differentiation between the involuntary experience and the voluntary experience. But when you set up game rules whereby you identify all that you do voluntarily with you and all that happens involuntarily with the other, with what happens to you, and then you put a gulf between these things, not realizing, and this is the secret that is never given away, that self and other are inseparable. Just in the same way that the front and the back of a coin are different but identical. It's all one coin. So in exactly the same way, the experience of self and the experience of other are mutually necessary. You wouldn't know what you meant by self unless you knew other. You wouldn't know other unless you knew what you meant by self. They are therefore polarities, like north and south pole of a magnet. They're inseparable. But that secret doesn't get out because civilized language and thought ignores the fact that all classes, all logical classes, and words are after all labels on classes, are so constructed that they are intellectual boxes, and every box which has an inside also must have an outside. And we think that insides exist apart from outsides, and outsides apart from insides. We don't realize that although they are opposed, they go together. And you see, that is the secret of the whole thing. That is what the child is not let onto. And so instead, the child is defined as a stranger in the earth, and not as a symptom of the earth. And as a result of that, we have the vast, terrifying social problem of alienation, of feeling that the world outside human skins is unfeeling, fully automatic stupidity, which we have to fight and dominate. Otherwise, it will swallow us up and condemn us to the imaginary terrors of everlasting nothingness.
Now, all neurotics, what we know about the neurotic is that he's a paralyzed man. Isn't that so? His emotions are very great, and they stymie him. And he can't act, or he can't move, he can't speak, can't write or paint, whatever it is he wishes to do. He's always thinking. He's always thinking in the future, and he's thinking in terms of perfection. This, perhaps, is the worst thing about it, don't you know? Well, the surrealists, by writing automatically, as they said, discovered that there is a great release the moment you forget the importance of what you're doing and only stop thinking. Please stop thinking is what they say, and let it come out, because it knows what it's doing. Do you see? Yes. So often I would begin, I couldn't begin, but I began. I began with anything. And after a page or two, I found myself right in the groove. Doesn't matter where you start from. You always come back to what you are. You can't get away from what you are, do you see? Even the men who are, you know, they take certain writers, they take a man like Flaubert, Balzac, Henry James, who are considered rather objective writers, do you see? They don't speak in the first person, isn't that so? And they have this great objectivity, they can build types, imaginative creatures, do you see? So it's always this something outside them. Nevertheless, no matter how much of that enters into their work, you can always see Henry James. You can always see Balzac, can't you? In everything that they do. Turgenev versus Dostoevsky, for example. Dostoevsky was delivering himself all the time. Turgenev was a polished stylist, the academician, you might say. But Turgenev can't get away from himself either. You recognize him in every line. Isn't that so? So it doesn't matter, as I say, how you approach a thing. You will always come back to your own self and your own obsessive themes. Dolly, by the way, spoke a great deal about the obsessive mania in the artist, as though to say an artist really is no good unless he is possessed and obsessed. And certainly Dostoevsky was a possessed man. Dolly strikes me more as an obsessed man, do you know? But at any rate, they're both, they're examples of men who are in the grip of something bigger than themselves, do you see? The other men are trying to avoid that.
What do you mean, the other men?
The other men. I mean those men whom the world looks upon more favorably, let's say, as more finished artists, more accomplished artists, the great novelists.
Name two.
Name two. Great novelists. Well, a Tolstoy, for example, as novelist, would be regarded in this way. On the other hand, I would put Dickens opposite him, a totally opposite character type, do you see? And who moved the world more? I would say possibly Dickens, do you see, who is a subjective sort of writer, who wrote, well, right from the immediate plasm of experience, do you see? Yes. But it was to be filled with a divine intoxication. Yes. And who celebrated that more in his writing? Rabelais. I have a wonderful passage in one of my books quoting Arthur Machen, the Welsh writer, who talks about the obscenity of Rabelais and who talks about the long word lists of obscene things that Rabelais reels off, do you see? And he says something to the effect, observe that this is no normal, ordinary cataloging. This is something abnormal. This is something supernormal, supercharged, that it has a meaning beyond it, do you see? That it's a divine intoxication. Yes.
It was a case of a breach of promise suit. I was down in the court. I always go down there. One fellow walked up before the judge, and the judge asked him, said, you ever been up before me? And the fellow said, I don't know, Judge, what time you get up? But it was a case going on where a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful girl, she had one of those low-cut gowns on. Her dress was cut so low in the back, it would make a baby cry. But she had been promised, this fella had promised her that he was going to take her to Florida. That's sort of case it seemed was going to be. And she told the judge this fella had promised her that he was going to take her to Florida. And this fella's only defense was, he told the judge, he said, Judge, I didn't say I was going to take her to Florida. I said I was going to tamper with her.
San Francisco, back of the Southern Pacific Station at 3rd and Townsend. In red brick of drowsy, lazy afternoons with everybody at work, in offices, in the air you feel the impending rush of their commuter frenzy. As soon they'll be charging in on Mars for market and Sansom building front foot and in buses and all well-dressed to working man Frisco of walk-up truck drivers. And even the poor grime be marked 3rd Street of lost bums, even Negroes so hopeless and long left east and meanings of responsibility and try. And now all they do is stand there spitting in the broken glass, sometimes 50 in one afternoon against one wall at 3rd and Howard. Here's all these Milbrae and San Carlos neat necktied producers and commuters of America and steel civilization rushing by with San Francisco Chronicles and green called bulletins, not even enough time to be disdainful. They've got to catch 130, 132, 134, 136, all the way up to 146, till the time of evening supper in homes of the railroad earth, when high in the sky the magic stars ride above the following hot shot freight trains. It's all in California. It's all a sea. I swim out of it in afternoons of sun-hot meditation in my jeans with head on handkerchief on brakeman's lantern or, if not working, on book. I look up at blue sky of perfect lost purity and feel the warp of wood of old America beneath me. And I have insane conversations with Negroes in second-story windows above, and everything is pouring in. The switching moves of boxcars in that little alley, which is so much like the alleys of Lowell, and I hear far off in the sense of coming night that engine calling our mountains. But it was that beautiful cut of clouds I could always see above the little SB alley. Puffs floating by from Oakland, or the gate of Marin to the north, or San Jose south. The clarity of Cal to break your heart. It was the fantastic drowse and drum hum of lum mum afternoon, nothing to do. Old Frisco with end of land sadness. The people, the alley full of trucks and cars of businesses nearabouts. Nobody knew or far from cared who I was all my life, 3,500 miles from birth, all opened up and at last belonged to me in great America. Now it's night in 3rd Street. The keen little neons and also yellow bulb lights of impossible to believe flops. The dark ruined shadows moving back of torn yellow shades like a degenerate china with no money. The cats in Annie's alley. The flop comes on, moans, rolls. The street is loaded with darkness. Blue sky above with stars hanging high over old hotel roofs and blowers of hotels mooning out dusts of interior. The grime inside the word in mouths falling out tooth by tooth. The reading rooms tick-tock big clock with creak chair and slant boards and old faces looking up over rimless spectacles bought in some West Virginia or Florida or Liverpool, England pawn shop long before I was born. And across rains, they've come to the end of the land sadness, end of the world gladness. All your San Francisco will have to fall eventually and burn again.
There was one fella, he came to my house one day, he took a worm out of his vest pocket. Just an ordinary worm you fish with. He took a worm out of his pocket and he had a glass of water and a glass of whiskey. And he put the worm in the water and the worm just wiggled around and swam. Then he took the worm out of the water and put him in the whiskey and the worm wiggled real hard and pretty soon he was dead. This fella says, see that fox just go to show you, don't it? He said, as long as you drink whiskey, you never have worms.
Poe, as you know, was a dishonorable figure, as it were, in American life or society. Isn't that so? There was something shameful about him in our eyes at that time. And Baudelaire, of course, definitely was. He had made himself such. I think Poe didn't try so hard. It just happened, you know, because he went against the grain. But Baudelaire flung himself in the face of society. He spat on society, you might say, huh? Yes, and that as the 19th century drew to a close, the artists who were prominent in the 19th century were all tragic figures. The 19th century, as you know, was a century of material progress, enlightenment, and rationalism, and so on. Yet the artists who have all become famous in that period are really all against that very thing. So they were all being crucified. I don't know how many of them meet early deaths, do you see? Die horrible deaths. They are denied, they're denigrated, they're persecuted. Nietzsche ends up in the asylum, you see. Van Gogh and Rimbaud both die within a year of each other at the ages of 34, do you see? Well, I don't have to go through the catalog. It's a whole history or a catalog of disaster. Yet all these men are filled with a vision of something better to come, do you know?
Wait a minute, Henry, I got to stop you here.
Yes.
You picked out six or eight names. Why do you pick the tortured spirits instead of the solid and complete spirits?
Because it was the tortured spirits who reflect the spirit, I think. It was the spirit that was being tortured in that century. Precisely that. You hit the crux of it in my mind. Do you see? The others represent, you might say, the status quo, the trend. The trend toward nowhere, so to speak, which is the usual trend. And the others are the afflicted ones. And the afflicted ones are always afflicted because they're trying to preserve something, maintain something that is vital to us, that lifts us up, that keeps us and nourishes us, don't you know? I say, yes, you take Blake. Well, he began in the 18th, he moves into the 90s. He's at the very threshold, don't you know? Very great figure. Prophetic figure, huh? An enigmatic one. Very big in the realm of poetry, you know, and philosophy, if you like, or religion. Yeah, great, great figure. And you have Nietzsche, you know, in the middle again, do you see? Then you have crazy men like Strindberg. Then you have even that fairly sane man, Ibsen. Look at his dramas. What revolt. What a castigation of society you have there. Don't you know? Isn't that so? It shows you the modern world falling apart. Its dilemmas are petty dilemmas, so to speak. Don't you know, huh?
Henry, how do you explain the fact that that a man of our generation, and we are contemporaries, as we sit across this table. Henry, how do you explain this choice in this 19th century of these special figures? What is so modern about them? Why do they appeal to modern man, do you think? What is the link between the names that you pick out, Blake and Ibsen?
Nietzsche
and others.
Okay.
In other words, what do you think appeals to modern man in these figures who are not modern?
I think that they represent in their work, or they delineate his peculiar tragedy, that they previsioned it. They foresaw what was happening to the world and to man. I think it's primarily that. The others are depicting life around them, as every artist can always do. It's a petty labor of every day, this descriptive thing, you know, of recounting what is happening before your eyes. But the other men probe deeper and get to the real crux of man's problems. Primarily it was that man in the 19th century began to feel a loneliness which we do not know about, at least as I read history, I have never read it before, of a loneliness so great as the modern man feels. He has been feeling it for a century now, and he's getting more and more lonely, more and more atomized, as it were, do you see? He's been blown apart, you might say. He's lost. He's in a world where he has no bearings. He's on his own, that's another way of putting it, as he never was before either. Because in the past, he had tradition, he had convention, he had God and church, you know? He had an organized society, quite strong. There were castes, there were grades, and so on. Today, all that is gone, you see? And a man has to save himself. There are no longer any intermediaries. There are no intercessors. A man, there is nothing on the horizon today, as there were in other perilous times. Great leaders who might lead man, like a Moses out of the wilderness, a leader like a Christ. We have had a Gandhi, it is true. It is true. This is in India. India is still quite a different world than this one we're living in, this modern world. It still has more of the aura of the spiritual connected with it, huh? And it is linked closer still with the past. But we have broken all those ties, do you see? And now it's man naked before the world, as I see it, do you see? And it's up to him to save himself. He can no longer look to anyone else for help. Each man must save himself. That is what I think is both the desperate quality and the excellent quality about this modern age. This great problem, the great challenge, in other words. Do you see? Man has got to recognize himself as somebody, as a being, something more than just what we call a human being, or go down, or perish. He has no other supports, as it were. Nothing is holding him up. He's alone. Each one alone in the world. Well, this is how I interpret it, Ben. The situation, the drama. In other words, if I... Now I risk going a little more philosophic with you. But actually, it's been said time and again by various people, strange people perhaps, there will never be again a savior for man. There, we have had enough saviors. We've had an end of saviors. They have done all that is possible. They have shown man the way. Now man must find it for himself on his own, do you see? He cannot be saved anymore. He must save himself. Well, this is a great thing, a big thing. And I think ultimately it's a good thing.
Then you don't really mean man's tragic position, because that's the word you use.
Well, it is tragic in the sense that it's profoundly weighted with the good and bad, you see. There is the balance, there's the risk, there's the challenge. You know, it's live or perish. And live, I mean by that, up to your maximum. You see, we can't live anymore on this, shall I say, mediocre scale on which we've been living. We can't live just believing and hoping and worshiping. That's something more, I mean. Now we have to be really imbued with the faith to a degree that we act upon it. It's been too long, the whole history of the world, the religious history, to my mind, has been the history of man living on crutches. Now we're throwing those crutches away. You have a chance to deny that there is such a thing as a God and justice and beauty and so on in the world, or to accept it fully and make this world all that the great ones in the past have promised us it is or would be, do you see? And it's not in the sky, in tomorrow, in the hereafter, but it's right now that it should be done and can be done. That's the thing. Thank you.
John Coltrane?
Well, there are things I learned from Miles. It's hard to put them into words, but there are things of the music and news to know. Can you hear it? Mm-hmm. Although it's hard for me to put it into words, but on hearing it, I sometimes can try to bring it out of myself. Mm-hmm.
I think Elvin Jones is one of the greatest percussionists that ever lived, and I don't think any other drummer could have gone toe-to-toe with Train the way Elvin did.
Max Roach.
It shaped, it sort of shaped itself, see, through individual contribution and effort. That way, everybody can kind of develop in their own sense of musicianship, too, because they have to make their own choices and decisions, you know, musical decisions. Which gives me ideas, see. Because I can't think drums like Elvin Jones. I can't think bass like Jimmy Gass. You know, I can't think piano like McCoy. You know, I can't do it. They know much more about those instruments than I do. Much more. So it's better for me to not, you know, try to impose too many of my ideas on them.
At times he'd put down his horn, man, and just beat on his chest, man, and just make noise with his mouth into the microphone. And change up his mouth, his sound with his mouth. He'd hold the saxophone be hanging, and he'd be screaming at the mic and beating on his chest. And they was flipping out on it. I'd say, Train, I'd say, man, why you do that, man? Why you beating on your chest and howling in the microphone, man? He said, man, I can't find nothing else to play on the horn. He exhausted the saxophone. What he say? He couldn't find nothing else to play. He started screaming. That was his words. He ran out of horn. He ran out of the horn.
Max Roach.
I heard many things in what Train was doing. I heard the cry and wail of the pain that the society imposes on people, and especially black folks. And I heard also the extraordinary contribution he made to music, rhythmically and melodically and harmonically. And I also heard the innovative use of that instrument. He took it to places that were individual to him, and he fed the whole world like that.